our slogan 2 years ago was what's important now. And I love that. It's just like every time you get to the bench, you think what's important now, what's important now. And the next shift is something new. And you just take it one little bite size at a time. So shrink everything. That's a metaphor for a million other situations.
Hello and welcome to the Friends of McGill Hockey Leadership Line Change Podcast. On this podcast, we interview McGill Hockey alumni to tease out the habits, leadership qualities, and life lessons that have brought them success in their domain. Today's interview features Luke Medill from Kirkland, Quebec. Luke played for McGill from 2003 to 2007, acting as assistant captain from 2005 to 2007. He graduated from McGill with a degree in kinesiology and went on to get an education degree and a master's degree in sports psychology from the University of New Brunswick. While there, he won the U Sports National Championship as assistant coach, as well as U Sports silver medal as a player. Luke has continued his winning ways as a teacher, hockey coach, and mental performance coach at St. Andrew's College. He has also worked as the mental performance coach for Hockey Canada, where he was part of the 2018 gold medal winning under 18 team at the Hlinka tournament. Luke currently resides in Stouffville, Ontario with his wife, Christine, and twin daughters, Abby and Marley. As a player, Luke was part of the country's best PK while skating alongside linemate and good friend, P.A. Paquette. This accomplishment, however, pales in comparison to the fact that his wife, Christine, set the CIS record for goals in a season. Without further ado, let's get started. Luke, how are you?
I'm great now. That was a pretty complete intro. Wow. Great stuff, Erx.
So to get started, just tell us a little bit about what you've been up to and how you got from graduating from McGill to where you are now.
Yeah, so I graduated from McGill, and probably like everybody who's there, you debate the fifth year there, pro hockey, going somewhere else. I kind of missed all the I wasn't actually thinking about continuing schooling, but there was always part of me that wanted to do sports psychology. Wayne Hollowell, Dr. Hollowell, who a bunch of the McGill people know, obviously he's been really closely related with the program. He had mentioned something about David Scott, and my sister went to UNB and studied with David Scott, took all his classes. He's the sports psychologist there at UNB. And so I applied last minute. Gardner McDougall, the hockey coach, was great there. He didn't think the late application was an issue. I got in and started studying under David Scott right away, who was great. He was with the Florida Panthers at the time. Now he's with the Canadiens, where he's been for a while. So, and then Ryan Hamilton was doing his PhD then. So I'll mention him a little bit later, but Ryan was an awesome influence too. So I went right into played a fifth year, which was great. And then I coached right after. So it wasn't really the plan the whole time, but it sort of felt that way. Like when I was there, I wasn't a captain on the team, but Gardner was so great with me. I think he felt like a fifth year guy. He could call me in for things. So they had won the national championship before I got there. So you're always a little bit, I think, skeptical going to a new program and worrying about changing anything or stepping on anyone's toes, but they were so great. They'd ask my opinion on things, use me on the PK, as you mentioned. Anyway, so I did the masters. I finished there. So I played a year, coached a year, and then still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I loved teaching. I was teaching sports psychology courses. Anytime Scotty would leave, I ran all his labs, did a couple lectures, and I loved it. And actually had a bunch of the players on the team in the courses. And then I thought, well, maybe teaching will be a way to go. So I stayed another year to coach and did teacher's college. And then I got in touch with a school called the Hill Academy, which was a sports school in Toronto, and got that job out of teacher's college. So I came to Toronto, coached and taught there. And right away when I got there, the very first class I taught English, I had three kids in the front row sitting beside each other. It was Laura Stacey, Aaron Ambrose, and Devin Shore. So Laura and Aaron are both with Team Canada now, and Devin Shore made the NHL. And I thought, wow, what kind of program? Like, you have three kids like that in a classroom of 12. So that was an amazing place to learn about teaching, coaching, and then sports psychology, because I got to talk to all these players at a young age and now see where they are. And we also had a bunch of great other players like the Ritchie brothers, Mitch Marner. There was a ton of kids at the school. So really amazing experience, again, coming right out of university. And then I was there for 5 years, and then a job opened up at St. Andrew's College, which I applied for and got. And I've been teaching and coaching there. And Dave Manning, the hockey coach there, has brought me on to help with the mental performance at St. Andrew's with their first team. And I coach the U16 team, teach. And yeah, about 4 years ago, I got invited to work with Hockey Canada as a mental performance coach as well. So that's kind of been the summer job The first year I did at St. Andrews was gracious enough to let me go to the U17 tournament, Dawson Creek, British Columbia. So I did that. And then the last couple of years have been summer only. So it really works well with a teaching schedule. I do a little bit of consulting on the side with athletes that I do at nighttime, usually on Zoom. And that's it. So that's a big mouthful of an answer for you. But that's how I got to where I am here.
Well, that's a good way to start. So let's bring it back to your time at McGill. Maybe share a brief story of something really fun that you did. So what was something that was a fun story from your time there?
Man, I don't even know where to begin. There's so many fun things. Like I just remember getting there and looking up to the veterans on the team. So whether it was Joel and Jack, Dan Jacob and Orzy and Blunds, like a lot of these guys, they lived a really balanced life. Like I think they played really hard, but they also knew how to have fun. And I lived near Dan Jacob my first year, so on St. Urbain. So that was great. PA was up in the plateau as well. So I had a little bit of fun there. And I mean, I used to love going to BDP on like, what was it, Monday nights? When was beer pong night? I used to love that. There was something every night of the week. So I think I'd have to think about the place. Like Gertz was huge on I would say Thursdays after the season, never during the year. I could go on and on. There was the carnival. Like I remember wearing that puke suit. I think the first year I was there, we got eliminated from playoffs, but I remember having that puke suit on at one point for, it felt like 12 days straight. I wasn't even in management. So that was really fun. And God, there were so many, like, I don't know where to begin. It was just a really, really fun time. I thought we played really hard and knew how to discipline ourselves and enjoy Sunday nights at Tokyo. So we had a really good time. I feel like a different person now. I can't even remember that guy. If I have one drink a week now, I feel sick. So I don't know how we pulled that off. But
so switching gears a little bit, want to start teasing out some habits and things that can be passed on to the current McGill team and alumni. So what book or podcast would you recommend to the current team?
I don't even know where to begin. Like for a team, I'd say Legacy would be amazing. It's one of my top ones. I'd say for the team, because it's an easy read, not very long. For the coaching staff, like Barcelona Way and Cubs Way are two of my favorites. Like they're just awesome, awesome books. Like those two and Culture Code are three, I think, that are on building a culture. The captains would probably read Legacy. I'd say for individual discipline, like if someone thinks they work hard, then something like Living with a Seal is hilarious, but also so motivational. My buddy, Ryan Hamilton, who I mentioned before, is with the Tampa Bay Lightning, and he was asking about some books that they could read. And I know they read Living with a Seal before the final round of the playoffs. So all the players got it, and he said they were loving it. So that's a big one, I think, just because it just shows you a whole different light of human being. And then a couple simple ones for the players, like Chop Wood, Carry Water, I think is really good by Joshua Medcalf. It's a simple read, simple chapters. I think it's written for young athletes, but it's a really good one. He's got another one called Pound the Stone that I like a lot too. So those are two simple ones for athletes. If they're really overwhelmed with their school schedule and they want to get some mental skills, and those would be two of the top choices.
Good variety there. So moving on. What is one quote or saying that has been helpful in your life and why?
My dad always used to say, people won't remember what you said or what you did, but they'll always remember the way you made them feel. So that was one. I feel like now you look back at McGill, like we're getting close to, you know, I'm 38 now. So it's getting further away, further removed. And when you ask about specific stories, it's really hard to remember specifics, but you definitely remember the people that made you laugh, the people that made you feel good. So that's, you don't remember all, and if they made you feel bad, you remember it too. So that would be really good advice. And then I've got on my computer here, it goes everywhere I go, this quote. It says, "He who angers you conquers you." And I don't think people think I'm an angry guy or anything, but now that I teach, I read that line like 500 times a day, because I can get so mad if a student does something and I can't let it anger me. So that's a big one for me, like controlling your emotions and keeping your head straight.
Now bringing it back to your time at McGill and things that you've learned since then, what advice would you have wanted to have given yourself entering your first year at McGill?
I wish people, like everyone talks about staying present now, like staying in the moment and enjoying it. And I think I also, there's two things. There's that, and now I read so much. Like when I got there, I don't know if students get like this now, but I just wanted to get a degree and play hockey. I wasn't really interested in the content. I should have been, because now I find myself like, I remember a couple of years ago, I bought my sports psych textbook from school that I didn't even bother buying when I was a student. Like I felt like I was not there for maybe later on in my career there, I started to get a little more interested. And then when I started my master's, I was so into school. Like I did so much better at teacher's college and master's. I was just so much more into the books. So one, like choose things you actually want to learn and then value that. I think there's so many of us that you want to play pro after, but when I finished my fifth year at university, I was done. I loved hockey, but I didn't want to play anymore. And I never would have thought I would have felt that way my first year. Like I loved it, but I was ready to start working. And I was so interested in other things. Like I got super interested in sports psych when I started it. So I would tell the athletes to start thinking, not thinking that way, like your career might end soon, but to start thinking that there's things that are going to excite you, that if you're studying, that they'll excite you as much as playing did. And as much as I love playing now, I love finding a good book on the topic. Like I got called to play hockey tonight, and I'm, you know, sometimes if I'm on a good book, I'm like, well, that means I can't read tonight. Like, so I just think that finding those things you interest in, finding your passion there and not thinking only about getting your degree and then finding a place to play. I feel like that's really important for everybody to consider, and not trying to limit careers or anything, just because I think they'll find a lot of value in it for themselves. So that goes back to staying present, because you just play each day and don't worry so much about the future. Because if you play each day, you like what you learn, then everything else will take care of itself.
So on that same topic of advice, moving forward a few years now for graduating students, what's a piece of advice that you would give someone graduating and entering the workforce? And then also on that same note, what's some advice that you hear maybe in your profession that they should ignore?
Off the top of my head, I would say like both things I did early on. I don't want to say that the current students are entitled. I know people hear that a lot, like the new generation, the Gen Z, and it might be a little bit true. But I do think that people have to have that mentality. You got to do everything. Like I know both jobs I had early on, you do everything possible. You volunteer for everything. You put in all the hours, but not just because you're doing it for a show. You also get to meet everybody, learn everything about the job, but never feel like you're above anything, because it's such a, one, you learn great work habits, but you also endear yourself to people for the right reasons. So not feeling like you deserve something just because you graduated from a certain school or because you believe you have a certain status. So I would say do everything possible right away, get involved, learn everything, and meet people. Like I know it both, like any social that started my first couple of years at my old job, this job, I'd go to it because you talk to people, you make friends, and there's more people that you can help out of a bind. They help you out of a bind. I've had a couple with my daughters recently that I've needed help with, and it's so much easier to ask people when you have great relationships. So I think people, like you just, it's, I think everything is about people and who you know. And I feel like some of the opportunities I've got with Hockey Canada, especially are through the people I've met, because you have good relationships and you never know which relationship will come back to either reward you or be something that you maybe wish you had been friendlier. So I think that's a big one, is being friendly to everybody for the good of being a nice person, but also because it could always come around.
And then on the other side of that, is there some advice that you've heard that you think people should ignore?
I know people always say, like in sports psychology, you don't want to be outcome based. And I think it's the same. I don't think you choose anything just for money. I think you choose it for people and happiness. And such a cliche, but love going to work. Like I love Mondays. I love going to work on Mondays. I love to see my colleagues. I love to teach. Like, I just think it's such a nice feeling when I see my friends dreading a Sunday night and they're lawyers or investors. Not that those are bad jobs, but I could tell they don't truly love it. At least those people in particular. And I, even though they're making maybe a lot of money, I just think, man, it would suck not to be excited to go to work. So maybe that's my advice.
Now I'd like to move to the topic of leadership. You've created a leadership course for the students at St. Andrews College. A lot of that material has been derived from all your research that you've done on the topic. So could you talk about some of the lessons you teach in that course and some examples of leadership behaviors you've observed while working as a mental performance consultant?
The course is made up of, it's about 6 to 7 weeks long. And we start off the first day, we define leadership. So one of the things I want the kids to or students to do. I don't want to tell them what leadership is, because I think there's a lot of different definitions, but I've got my own and then they give me their own, and everyone's got a different image of it. So we define it. We use clips from, you know, the Michael Jordan documentary that just came out to talk about his style of leadership and how that would work today, or if it wouldn't work today. We talk about authoritarian leadership, democratic leadership, the times that things are different. So the first one, we define it. The next one, we build a leadership philosophy. So the boys all, they all have to create their own statement, like a philosophy statement that could sort of be like a compass for them. And then the next day they have to say, rather than pick apart the coach's culture that they're involved in as athletes, or even if it's in a classroom, they have to say, if you were in charge, what would be the, what would your culture be? So they have to create their own. And I try to use a bunch of readings. So from Barcelona Way and Culture Code and Cubs Way, and try to incorporate all that. So they read these examples and then they have to create their own. A big one, I give them readings from The Score Takes Care of Itself, where they talk about Bill Walsh when he reconstructed his culture. And then the fourth one to me is the most fun, and it's decision-making. So the boy, I give them a bunch of dilemmas and then they have to test, they have to give their instinctual answer, but then they test it on the values they created the weeks before. That's the most fun one. Like, I think they, it's so interactive. They get to justify their decisions. And then we move to communication skills the next week. And then finally they do a final presentation, which is always great to hear. And I think like one of the themes of the course is leading without a title. So when you ask about the best examples I've seen, I hate name dropping with them, but I love to, there's some great ones that I have. And at the under 18 championship that we won 2 years ago, when Alexis Lafreniere was our captain, he wasn't the vocal leader in the room. Like, he was an awesome kid. Everybody loved him. He was definitely the best player in the tournament. So he was the captain and he was definitely led by the way he played. But to me, he led by following so well. Like, he would do whatever was asked of him. If the coaches said, we're doing a relaxation meeting when we get back at 1 a.m. and I had to run it, it was just so much easier because he was all in. So like one of the first nights, it was so late, the coaches said, let's do an optional relaxation session tonight. And he showed up, him and three other guys. And because they were showing up, a bunch of other guys followed. And then we just made them all mandatory. And then if the trainer was doing an active warm-up and it was like a game of tic-tac-toe or duck, duck, goose, he was always all in. So it wasn't his, he just bought into everything we did, every off-ice team builder. And because he had the respect of people in the room, everybody else did it. It just made coaching so much easier for me as a mental performance guy. It made that so much easier. And I only bring it up because I've seen the opposite. Like my first year when I was doing it, there was probably a couple of kids that were a little bit resistant to it. And just a couple of those barriers, they really negatively affect you. So I love, like, I mean, I really can't wait to follow Lafreniere's career. I think he's an awesome, awesome kid, but it was more importantly, just like that lesson of being a leader just by buying into whatever is asked of you. And that doesn't mean conforming to bad things. It means, you know, you're all in. And if there was ever an issue, you talk about it behind closed doors, but he was never publicly defiant of anything. And everybody else just followed suit.
Now I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here. And think about some of these teams you've worked with, or just in your general experience, are there any leadership behaviors that people should avoid?
Yeah, there's so many players with great leadership qualities, but they'll lead in the wrong direction. So like, to me, one of the biggest ones is just, there's a scene, Saving Private Ryan, where he says, you never gripe down. And that's the biggest one. Like, anytime you're in any kind of leadership position, you should never gripe to those below you. So as a teacher, I should never complain about the new lunch schedule to the students. The prefects who are the leaders of our school, they should never complain to the normal students. It always goes up. It sounds like a big thing, but the little complaining attitude, even where you think you're standing up to something, you try to, you know, Christine, my wife has said this to me too before. Like, sometimes I'll get caught complaining. She says, well, can you do something about it? If I say no, she'll say, well, then don't complain about it. And if I say yes, she'll say, well, then do something about it. And that's really it. Like, you should never complain, because you either do something about it or you don't, because you can't change it. So yeah, complaining to those below you. And I don't mean below you, like, I think everybody's equal in their own right. But if there's a hierarchy of the team where you're a captain or assistant coach, you should never complain to those that are lower on that hierarchy of leadership in terms of the structure of the team or organization.
And thinking back to your career, your playing days, What are some leadership lessons you derived from hockey, and how has it influenced what you're doing now?
It's funny. I thought PA was, he became a really close friend of mine, even though he falls off the planet on me now. The first day I got to McGill, we were doing, we did our fitness training. And I remember he just seemed like such a, like he seemed like such a hard ass. He wasn't that friendly to me the first day. He was so intense during the run. And I was like, man, this guy, what's his problem? And then early on, I think that first game, first exhibition game, he was on my line and he was so intense on the bench. And I kept thinking like, man, I'm with this guy. He's such an idiot. And like the first rush we had on, he drove the net so hard. It was like a scrimmage and he took the crossbar off, like went head first into it. And I was like, so I went from thinking the guy was nuts to all of a sudden thinking, man, this guy's like, he's crazy. Like he'll do anything to win. And I loved it. And then we became PK partners, but what I learned from him, like he was so devoted to the win, like he'd do anything to win. And it was never for personal glory. Like BA didn't score a lot of goals, but he could potentially be the guy you'd have on the ice at the end of the game because he might score in that situation. Like he was just so intense, but so selfless, like never, never any self-promotion. And like a, maybe not the most skilled player, but could hold other people accountable. Like just developed a work ethic and a sacrifice that he could call our best scorer out about something he did wrong and not get a hairy eyeball. Like, how dare you have the nerve? But he earned it. So I noticed it right away and noticed it on that run on the 200 meter track at McGill. And that would be a lesson that I took for leadership.
A little bit of a similar topic. So moving from leadership to mentors, who have been in the important mentors in your life?
I've had great coaches. Like coaches are always great mentors. So, and my father too, like I talk about Herbie all the time, but we're obviously different players. He was a scorer and I wasn't for university, but my prep school coach, Bob Howe, was just such a good guy, and not because of his system, just did everything the right way. Marty was a great influence on me. I thought Marty was just so prepared, so intense. Gardner McDougall was probably, I'd say, the biggest influence on my professional life because I was more mature by the time I interacted with him, that my memory is more fresh. And Gardner, I thought, like as a player, there were so many times where I didn't think, I was like, man, I don't know if we're going to mesh as coaches. Like when I started, because sometimes I wouldn't understand his decisions or I'd be mad about it. And then when I finally worked with him, I saw how much thought went into his decision, whether it was to like put someone on a certain line or if he had to scratch a guy or if he, like it would eat him up, but he never showed it. And he prepared for everything. And he was the first guy I saw who seemed like an intense, manly coach who read like crazy. Like he was such a learner and he still is. We still talk all the time about our books and he'll write pages of notes on each book that he takes. And he says, if you ever want to tell how much I like a book, open the cover. Cause that's where he writes all his notes. And he was the first guy that really made me like, I was into reading, but not as much until I started coaching with him. And then I just became like obsessed with it. And I don't know if it's cause I'm doing it. Like maybe there's part of me that wants to be able to talk to him about it and say, hey, here's what I read. Cause I used to love those conversations with him. Like Gardner, I could talk all day after a game. And I know you've met him and talked with him and he's just such a, so he was probably the biggest influence on me when I became an adult. And then Ryan Hamilton from UNB has been a huge influence on me as well. And there's so many, I don't want to forget names, but professionally, those guys have been the biggest for me.
I want to hear your thoughts on facing high pressure situations. And you've been exposed to a few of these working with Hockey Canada and as a mental performance consultant. So what's some advice you give to people when you need to make a difficult decision? What specific tactics or tools or processes you recommend?
I'd say in like the highest pressure situations, I had a chance. There's a guy who wrote the book Hockey Tough, Saul Miller's a sports psychologist, and I sat down with him a couple of years ago. He was at our school working with the national sledge team, and again, I'd heard this before, but it was just fresh in my mind. But he talked about how you got to shrink everything, like everything, you just make everything smaller. So for example, if you're in a really high pressure situation as a player, well, if you're used to taking 60 second shifts and you shrink it to 30, now you have half the length of time to make a mistake and double the energy. So you don't focus on a minute shift, you get down to 30. If you like making cross ice passes, well, there's a lot that can go wrong in a cross ice pass. So shorten your pass. If you are thinking about 100 different options, like of what you should be doing, you get it, shrink it down to 3, either skate, chip it, or like move it backwards. Like, so just shrink the entire game as small as possible, like shrink your decisions, shrink your threshold of being able to make mistakes, and then to constantly reset every time you get back to the bench. So you breathe. With the U18s, our our slogan 2 years ago was what's important now. And I love that. It's just like every time you get to the bench, you think what's important now, what's important now. And the next shift is something new. And you just take it one little bite size at a time. So shrink everything. That's a metaphor for a million other situations.
The best example I've seen of a player like shrinking things and making it smaller, it wasn't even my lesson. It was just at the recent under 18. So from 2 summers ago, cause there was none this year, we had this big game against Sweden. Sweden was unbelievable. Like their goaltender was amazing. He's just a young guy, but he was so big and no one could score on this guy. So we got to play them and it was like one of those games where right away you could tell it's going to be impossible to score. Like you're throwing everything at them, but nothing's going in. And they went ahead and this was an elimination game to get to the final. And I think we were all like, oh my God, how are we going to score? Like nothing's going in. The ice conditions are so crap. Like there's puddles all over the rink and Breklav. And then Perfetti got a breakaway on this guy, Cole Perfetti. And he scored this amazing goal. I think he shelved it on that one on his backhand. And then they scored again. And then a little bit later, Cole got another breakaway and he scored. He went the other side and shelved it. So it was unbelievable. Like this guy was scoring. Then we got to a shootout and Cole scored our first shootout goal. And then we went through all the other shooters. No one else scored. So it went to the next round. Cole went again. He scored again. And then he went again and he scored again on this unbelievable goaltender. So the next day I kind of had a bit of a good rapport with him because I used to teach at the school that he was attending. So we had some mutual acquaintances. So on the next day we kind of just rubbed shoulders on our morning walk. And I knew what I would have been thinking if I was him. I would have said, like, I was just thinking about missing or I'm going to be out of moves. How could I score this many times on such a good goaltender? That's what I would have been thinking at his age. And I didn't want to tell him that, but I said, so what were you thinking about? And he said, honestly, after the first breakaway, when I made a move, I saw a hole. And I just kept thinking, if I make a move, I'm going to see a hole. So every time I went in, I wasn't thinking what score. I just thought, make a move, you'll see a hole, and then shoot it to the hole. And to me, that was just the perfect example of shrinking it, like not thinking about the outcome, not thinking that I have to score, just thinking I'll make a move. And then if I see a hole, I'll try and hit the hole. And you don't get mad about missing it because it's the same objective all the time. So for me, I learned a ton from that example from Cole and thank him for that. And definitely I've really enjoyed using that as an example for the other players I work with now, because it was just such a great visual tool for me to learn from.
Any other processes, any specific things that you use? Those are some good examples.
Yeah, I just think having like anchors, like I know Rafa Nadal, just one that he just tied Federer. I love Nadal. In his book, he talks about how he's got, you know, he takes these two water bottles and he puts them where his foot should be. He'll always look at them. So when he does his imagery before a match, he imagines those bottles there, and then he'll imagine all the successful things he's going to do after. When he's actually playing, if things aren't going well, he'll look at those two bottles being right where they were when he did his imagery. And that helps him reset, refocus. It's kind of like a tether. It just brings him right back to where he should be. So having something like a cue that can help you recenter, it could be that bullseye on your stick, like Wayne Hall, he's talked to us at McGill about things like that, but just having something that when you see it, it reminds you of the way you're supposed to be. Cause you can't always count on yourself to think clearly in a pressure situation. So you need those reminders. You need those cues.
I like that. I figured you'd be the best guy to ask for this stuff. So this one's still staying on the habits and routines theme. In the last couple of years, are there any new habits or routines that have positively impacted your life?
So when I got to UNB, there was a really good player, good person. He's a really good student, Denny Johnson. He's a doctor now. And he told me that he treats everything like a 9-to-5 job, like at school as a student. So he gets up and he goes to work. And even though our practice would end at 5:30, he does nothing but work. So kids are throwing stuff on the quad, like they're throwing frisbees, they're doing whatever. He goes, I don't do it. I work my tail off from 9 to 5, but then at 5 o'clock, I'm done. I don't look at anything. And that's kind of, I feel like I've adopted that life. I've maintained that. So as a teacher, you have prep periods. There's time to hang out with other staff, and there's always tons of grading to do, like at nighttime. So I really try to do, and there's times when I have to do work at night, like when you have a ton of grading, but I really try to adopt that. Like when I go to work, I work my tail off. Like I try to use my prep periods productively, just work so hard. And then when I get home, it's like, it's family time and my time. Like I try to do that. There's now with consulting, sometimes even though it's a separate job, I'll do some stuff at nighttime, but really like filling the hours, like don't waste time. So I work all day, enjoy it. And then at nighttime, enjoy that. I think that helps a bit. It's really hard with the twins right now, but I really did feel like I've reached a point where I don't always have to take work home because I'm more effective during the day. So that would be one habit, like just making use of every free moment to stay on top of things and not letting things pile up.
Great. And last, how do you define mastery?
Oh my. It's a passion for wanting to do something better, taking pride in what you know, but also having the humility to realize that there's so many people that probably know more and there's still so much more to learn that you can constantly be excited by learning more and then bring that into your teaching of it. So that my definition is probably based on the viewpoint of a teacher because you're constantly trying to guide the learning of people that are younger than you, maybe not fill their heads with anything, but try to point them in the right direction. But I just love finding a new article that excites me for a class. And then I bring it in and I just love reading it. And I love that feeling I get, you know, the thought of not having them have that, your students have that feeling of you being excited. To me, you're depriving them of something. So not getting stale and not thinking that you know it all. Like, I think they share the people you're teaching in your enthusiasm that you're learning it too. Like, I think they feed off that because then you feel, you know, the culture code talks about being at an equal level and sharing vulnerability and letting them know that you don't know it all. So I think showing that, but then that passion is what they feed off of. So maybe mastery is just staying passionate in what you're doing.
Now, okay, we're going to close it off here. So to finish, I'm going to ask you a couple quick hitters. Yeah. And just want you to say first thing that comes to mind. Best bagels in Montreal.
Oh, it was Montreal bagel. Those are, but what was the one on St. Urbain there? The big paddles. Was that Montreal bagel or did they call it something else? I forget.
St. Viateur.
Yeah.
Or there's Fairmont. Fairmont.
Fairmont. The Fairmont bagels. Yeah.
Best smoked meat.
Oh man, Schwartz is no question.
I already think I know the answer to this one, but best late night eats.
That's a tie. That depends. If Belle Provence is 50 cent hot dogs, you get like 8 of them. Otherwise you go for a double pita pit on the way back there. That's equal satisfaction.
Always keep the safety 20 in there for that.
Maybe that's the advice I should be giving. Everyone keep a 20 in the back of your wallet at all times.
Anything better than Altos?
No, Altos is amazing. I mean, we were there the night before my wedding and it was insane. Like, I thought we were going to get booted out and the whole staff was dancing with everyone. It was the craziest night of the whole wedding weekend because Christine and I got married at McGill, on McGill's campus. But Altos, yeah, there's nothing better than that, man. I love that place.
And any hidden gems in Montreal that you'd recommend?
I mean, I love L'Académie for the bring your own wine. Like, that was a nice place to go. It was affordable as a student. But I probably wasn't I didn't explore as much of the town outside the McGill bubble as I probably could have. So,
well, Luke, I really want to thank you. I thought it was an outstanding interview and that was a lot of fun for me catching up and, you know, digging deeper on some of these topics you don't get to talk too often about. So with that, we'll wrap up today's podcast. Thanks everybody for listening and stay tuned for more episodes on the FMH podcast channel. Until next time, keep your elbows up and your sticks on the ice.